Hello, sports fans, and welcome to another edition of Yesterday Sports on the Sports History Network. And make sure to check out sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. I have two signed books I'm giving away. One is titled No Nonsense, Old School Weight Training, and the other is Reliving 1970s Old School Football.
Our journey through the All-America Football Conference continues, and this time we have the premier team from the league, the Cleveland Browns. Historian George Bozica tells us about the origin of the Browns and their brilliant owner and his head coach, who was the major innovator, Paul Brown, coming up in this episode.
This is the Pigskin Daily History Dispatch, a podcast that covers the anniversaries of American football events throughout history on a day-to-day basis. Your host, Darren Hayes, is podcasting from America's North Shore to bring you the memories of the gridiron one day at a time. So as we come out of the tunnel of the Sports History Network, let's take the field and go no huddle through the portal of positive gridiron history with PigskinDispatch.com.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at SportsHistoryNetwork.com.
Hello, my football friends. This is Darren Hayes of PigskinDispatch.com. Welcome once again to the Pigpen, your portal to positive football history. And we are continuing our journey into the teams of the All-America Football Conference. And we have about three of them left here. We've talked quite a bit about the Western teams, and there's one that we really haven't talked about, and we're going to discuss them tonight. And actually, these are the cream of the crop of the whole AAFC, the Cleveland Browns. And we're bringing in our expert historian from that area, George Bozica. Welcome back to the Pigpen.
Thanks, Darren. Always enjoy talking to you here in the Pigpen.
We really enjoy you. We get a lot of great response, George, when you come on. We appreciate your expert opinion. We've had a lot of experts talking about the AAFC, and it's very appreciative, and talking about this very interesting league that was so important to football, yes, to pro football. And we're talking about the kingpins of that league in your Cleveland Browns. And we're excited to hear about the origin story of the Browns and their trek through the AAFC. So I will let you start us off here wherever you'd like to begin.
Well, I'm sure some of this stuff may have already been sort of discussed in some of the previous ones, but obviously the All-America Football Conference was formed in 1944 by Arch Ward, who was a reporter and editor with the Chicago Tribune. He also was responsible for starting the baseball All-Star game and the college All-Star game, which doesn't exist anymore, but was a big thing back in the day in Chicago. And he envisioned sort of a World Series of football, American versus national. So with the National Football League, that's why he sort of got the idea to start, the All-America, football conference. And of course, the Cleveland franchise was basically secured by Arthur Mickey McBride. And Mickey McBride was the first owner of the Browns. And to say the least, he was a colorful character. Mickey McBride was actually born in Chicago. He knew Ward, Arch Ward, from his days in the newspaper business, because he was born in 1888, but he started as a newsboy. And, when we think of newsboy, we see sort of the movie version of these, kids that would be, selling newspapers. But it was actually a rough and tumble business back then. You had to be a bit of a tough guy back then to be a good newsboy, because, newspapers were competing with each other for circulation and things like that. And Mickey McBride made a name for himself actually working for the Chicago Evening American, which was William Randolph Hearst's paper in Chicago. And I'm sure everybody has heard of William Randolph Hearst, obviously the Hearst newspaper chain, and one of the more powerful newspaper men in American history. And he worked for Hearst newspaper, worked his way up through the circulation department there, and ended up then moving to Cleveland and becoming circulation manager at the Cleveland News in 1913. He actually, just some interesting side notes, because I just think he's a fascinating guy. You could probably do a show just on Mickey McBride. He at one time was accused of selling illegal streetcar transfers, and he was defended by Clarence Darrow. And I think everybody has heard of Clarence Darrow, you know, obviously the Scopes monkey trial and a variety of things. He was one of the more renowned defense counsels of that era. And Clarence Darrow being Clarence Darrow got him off on that charge. So, you know, he had this rather, I should say, colorful background. And it put him in contact, even though I want to emphasize that, you know, he was never actually found guilty of anything or anything like that, but he did have some ties to some organized crime figures. A couple of famous organized crime figures in the Cleveland area actually worked for him as newsboys at the time. One of them, Morris Mushy Wexler, went on to own a really famous nightclub in Cleveland called the Theatrical Grill, which was on a street in Cleveland called Short Vincent. And it was called Short Vincent because it was basically like a half a street, but it had this famous nightclub that was actually sort of a mecca for anybody that was a who's who in the entertainment industry back in that day. I mean, people like Milton Berle, Jimmy Durante, Perry Como, Dean Martin, Frank Sinatra, Joe DiMaggio were seen at the Theatrical. Marilyn Monroe and Arthur Miller, her then husband, a famous playwright. You know, it's unbelievable. If you see the list of everybody that was there at one time, it's an amazing list. And the person that owned that was one of Mickey McBride's, as I said, newsboys when he was in Cleveland, worked for him under the circulation department. And actually, Art Modell, when he made the deal to buy the Browns, he closed the deal at the Theatrical. Really? So as I said, this is really sort of a famous, you know, place. And McBride actually made his money, not just from the newspapers, but he invested in real estate. And then he also invested in what was called back then the wire service. And what the wire service was it was a mechanism that was used to basically supply information to bookmakers, race results and things like that. If you've ever seen the movie The Sting, the Sting or the con that's in The Sting basically made an illegal use of the wire service. And then what they did in The Sting is they got the information ahead of time, so then they knew what the result was going to be so that they could then take the bets and that way make money off the con. But when it was run just as a normal business, it was basically an information business, and they would supply the information to bookies or supply the information to pool halls or wherever people were making bets back then. And he was involved in that kind of situation too. But where he really made his money was that he owned cab service in Cleveland. He owned the Zone Cab and the Yellow Cab in Cleveland. So he was known basically as a taxi cab magnate. And actually the term taxi squad in football comes from Arthur McBride, because the Browns basically would sign players, and if they couldn't use the players, they worked for Mickey McBride at the taxi cab company.
So really? That way,
that's how the taxi squad term came into being.
Wow, that's pretty cool.
Yeah. So that's where that actually came from. As I said, he was never found guilty of any wrongdoing. He just had ties to, you know, some interesting people. Actually, when they had the Kefauver hearings during the 50s, the organized crime hearings in Congress, actually he was questioned by the Kefauver committee. And that was in 1951. And just a couple of years after that, he did divest himself of the Browns and sell the Browns. You know, some say, well, it was maybe because of that, but he said, no, he was basically, you know, ready to get out of the business at that time. The funny thing about him is that he really wasn't a football fan to start with. He was a big baseball fan and a big boxing fan, but his son went to Notre Dame and he would go, you know, attend games there, and he was just taken with all the, you know, sort of, you know, pageantry around the game and the excitement. And that's when he started to become hooked on football. So when the opportunity arose to get, you know, an ownership, you know, he was awarded the ownership. As I said, he had the tie with Arch Ward, knew Arch Ward. So he then became the owner of the Browns. Now, fortuitously, this obviously, the Browns obviously first season in the AAFC was in 1946. 1945, there was already a team in Cleveland, the Cleveland Rams. And that was owned by Dan Reeves. And I think we possibly talked about this on another show on the Sports History Network, because the book that's going to be coming out here soon, that the Pro Football Researchers Association in our Great Team series is going to be on the 51 Rams. Well, Dan Reeves, and that's the Los Angeles Rams. Dan Reeves was the owner of the Cleveland Rams. He had always wanted to own a football team. His story is in some ways is very similar to Mickey McBride in that, you know, he came from a money background. His family owned grocery stores. So he came from that background, always wanted to own a football team because he was hooked when he went out to Los Angeles and saw the college football games out there. And he became hooked, and eventually he bought the Cleveland Rams, not because he wanted to own a team in Cleveland, because Mickey McBride obviously had ties to Cleveland. He just wanted to own a football team. And he always wanted to take that team and move it out west. That was his goal. From the time almost that he bought that team, he wanted to move them out west. Well, in 45, they won the NFL championship. They beat the Redskins in Cleveland. And not soon after that, he got league approval to move the team out to Los Angeles. So as he was moving out, the Browns were moving in. And Mickey McBride was the owner. So it was sort of a fortuitous thing for the Browns to do that, because the Rams really hadn't had a lot of success in Cleveland at the ticket office. Some people blamed Reeves for that, but the point is that it never seemed to click for them at the ticket office in Cleveland. I think a lot of people in Cleveland now, when they hear about the Rams being in Cleveland, a lot of people in Cleveland don't even know that history. You know, every once in a while you'll see a story on the local news or in the newspaper. Well, did you know? And you know, a lot of people didn't know that the Rams existed in Cleveland. They always think of it as a West Coast team, but that's where it started. So at any rate, actually, Mickey McBride wanted to buy the Rams from Reeves, but he was turned down. So when he had the opportunity to basically get into the AAFC, he jumped at it. And, you know, that was true of some of the other owners, too. When we were talking about, for example, the Dons, you know, Don Ameche was one of the owners of the Dons. And, you know, he had wanted a team previous to that and was hoping to get a team in the NFL. And a lot of the owners in the AAFC, I'm sure, as you've discussed in some of the other shows, were men of means. A lot of these guys did have, you know, that kind of background and did bring money to the league. So he got the team, he got the franchise, he needed to get a coach. Initially, he wanted Frank Leahy. At that time, Frank Leahy was one of the more famous, you know, college coaches in the country at Notre Dame. Notre Dame objected, so McBride had to back off. He put out some feelers as to, you know, who would be a good person to hire, and the name Paul Brown came up. And I don't think you can talk about the Cleveland Browns without talking about Paul Brown, because I think at least in that iteration of the Browns, that early iteration, Paul Brown was the Browns. It was he that was the architect for the success that the Browns had. I know we've discussed in the show that we did about the Massa-McKinley series that, you know, Paul Brown, he started at a prep school, but he really made a name for himself when he came to Massa in high school. And he won, you know, 6 state championships there. He won 80 games against 8 losses and 2 ties. And he was basically dominating Ohio high school football at the time. And this was from during the decade of the 30s, from 1932 to 1940, he was the Massillon head coach. Just to show you how dominating he was and what kind of coach he was, the 1940 team, which was sort of considered his masterpiece, they actually just did an article about this in the paper about a week ago here locally. They played Kent State's college football team in a scrimmage that year and beat them 47-0. Wow. They were supposed to also scrimmage Akron University, and Akron backed out after they beat Kent State so bad.
No win situation for the colleges.
Yeah. And it was interesting because that was one of the things the article went into, was that, you know, the press at the time was really critical of Kent State for doing it, because you know, it was a no-win situation, but that's how good they were, you know, and that's how good a team that, you know, he had built up. So he went for Massillon, and then he was at Ohio State, won a national championship at Ohio State. And then during the war, he was at Great Lakes, where he coached at Great Lakes. When he was signed by the Browns, it was the richest contract that any coach had signed at that time. I've seen different sources that place the contract at anywhere between $17,500 to $25,000 a year. Not much money in today's standards, but it just goes to show you, you know, the difference in the time. You know, this was mid-40s, right after the war. The war was coming to a close. So, you know, that was a lot of money back then. You know, I often talked to my dad, who passed last year, about the value of money back then, and, you know, just what you could do with, you know, with a couple cents in your pocket. So that was a lot of money back then. He signed while he was still in the Navy. He got an ownership interest in addition to the salary, plus, and this is something that he wanted, because it was Paul Brown. That was his way. He wanted complete control over football operations. So he didn't have a meddling owner. He was the football operation. So McBride just sat back and supported him in any way he needed to be supported. But Paul Brown ran the team. He coached at Great Lakes in 1945, knowing that obviously the very next year he was going to be the Browns coach, because he had already, you know, made the commitment. Ohio State was not happy. They felt that Paul Brown was going to be their coach for a while. So, you know, he ruffled quite a few feathers amongst the, you know, powers that be at Ohio State. So obviously we had this Cleveland franchise, and I keep referring to them at the Browns, but they weren't named the Browns yet. The Cleveland Plain Dealer in May of 1945 had a contest to name the team. And they cautioned people not to pick the name Browns, because Paul Brown didn't want the team to be named the Browns, I think for obvious reasons. So the name that came up was the Cleveland Panthers. But when that name came up, Paul Brown rejected it, because there had been a 1920s semi-pro team named the Panthers, but they weren't very successful. And he said, I'm not going to be associated with failure. So they went back to the drawing board. And for a while, there was a story that was bounced around that they were named after Joe Louis, because Joe Louis was known as the Brown Bomber. But truth be told, the name Browns became the name. It was the most popular, and it was because of Paul Brown. So that was how the Browns, you know, got their name, even though there's stories out there that it was, you know, the Brown Bomber and all this. It was that. That's basically what it was.
So there was no connection to, like, the baseball team that was the St. Louis Browns.
No connection.
Okay.
There was this contest, and actually the most popular choice was the Browns, even though people were told not to choose the Browns. But then they went with the Panthers, and Paul Brown wasn't happy with that. So in a roundabout way, they became the Cleveland Browns. So he then set about organizing his coaching staff. And in Michael McCambridge's great book, America's Game, he refers to Paul Brown as the organization man. And I think that's probably the key thing that I think Paul Brown did better than anybody else at that time, was he was an organized guy. You know, he was very organized from top to bottom in the way he was going to run his football team. And he went about hiring his coaching staff. He hired people like Blanton Collier, who was out of Kentucky. He had also been in the Navy, and also was at Great Lakes. As some of your listeners may know, Blanton Collier went on to be a great head coach in the NFL for the Browns after Paul Brown was fired by Art Modell. He had a great record, won one NFL title in 1964, beating a pretty highly favored Colts team with John Unitas, 27-0. Gary Collins got three touchdown passes in that game. And then they made it to the championship game the next year against the Lombardi Packers, when the Packers still had Paul Hornung. and Jim Taylor and that whole group, and they lost to them 23-12 in sort of a quagmire. But they made the playoffs almost every year, not quite every year Batenkire was there, but he had a very successful turn as a head coach. He also hired Fritz Heisler, who he knew from Maslin and Miami of Ohio, because Paul Brown had matriculated at Miami of Ohio. So he knew him. He hired John Brickles, who was from Newark, Ohio, and he actually had coached at New Philadelphia High School in Ohio. And he was actually succeeded at New Philly by Woody Hayes, of all people. Woody Hayes was a high school coach at one time. And he actually sort of acted as Paul Brown's recruiter, so to speak. He also hired Creighton Miller, who famous at Notre Dame. And he later became an attorney and later became Brown's legal counsel. And he was one of the people that was really key in forming the NFLPA. Bob Voigt was another man on the coaching staff. He was basically also at Great Lakes. And Red Conklight, if I say that right, he had played in the NFL and actually was with the 45 Rams, believe it or not. So there's another tie-in with the Rams. So he put together his coaching staff. And one of the things that Paul Brown had done is he sort of made notations and almost dossiers. It was described in one source that I read of players that he was familiar with through the years, whether it was his years at Maslin or whether it was his years at Great Lakes or his years at Ohio State, not only players that he coached, but players that he coached against. So he sort of had an idea of what the best talent was out there for different positions.
He had a massive Rolodex is what you're saying.
Yes, he did. And he used that to his advantage in terms of, you know, putting together his squad. He had great attention to detail. He was very old school. You know, he wasn't always liked by everybody, but I think when you win, sometimes you aren't liked by everybody. I think, you know, the modern example of that is Bill Belichick. You know, people, you know, I think Bill Belichick, in a lot of ways, from what I've read about Paul Brown, is very much a modern day Paul Brown in his approach and his analytical approach to the game. You know, I sort of see a lot of similarities there between the two. And I know from what I've heard, Belichick had great respect for Paul Brown. You know, he was old school in the sense of, you know, the way he treated and disciplined his team, but he would give up drinking. He would give up playing cards. He would give up golf during the whole football season. He didn't want any distractions. You know, he loved the opportunity to be able to operate and build the team from the bottom up. That's what he enjoyed. And some said that he brought, you know, intelligence to the game because he looked at it also as a chance to teach. And he was very much approached the game as a teacher to teach the athletes to play in a certain way and to play a certain style of football. He wanted high class people. And, you know, that's what he went after. There's a story of a certain player that he had that he basically got rid of late in the one season because he was partying and it came to the attention of Paul Brown. He didn't want that. He wanted his players to be high-class people. He expected them to dress a certain way and look a certain way. Shirt, tie, suit, you know, they had to act, you know, the part. He wanted them to act that way, you know, which I think is sort of refreshing because, you know, he wanted his players to carry themselves a certain way with respect. And, you know, he brought that. So he knew early on that they were going to be a T formation team. And he knew that the guy that he wanted to be his quarterback was Otto Graham. And he had actually played against Otto Graham because Otto Graham came out of Northwestern. And he had actually been a tailback in the single wing at Northwestern. But Northwestern at the time had upset Brown's OSU team in 41, and he never forgot that. So he felt that based on the skills that Otto Graham showed, that he would be a good T formation quarterback. So he was going to build around Otto Graham. And he picked a lot of players that still had some college eligibility left. But another common thread in the players that he picked for the Browns was a number of them were military or war vets. So they came after the war, and even though some of them still had some college eligibility left, they were more mature because of their experience in the war. So he brought in people like Lou Groza and Lynn Houston and Dante Labelli, who had all been at Ohio State. And even though they had some eligibility left, he was able to pluck them, and they wanted to go into pro football. Now, as I said, that didn't sit right in Columbus because he was taking some good talent away, but he knew what he wanted. He picked up Max Speedy, who just recently was inducted into the Hall of Fame. And obviously Lou Groza and Dante Labelli are in the Hall of Fame. Max Speedy came out of Utah. Frank Gatzke, his great center, who's also in the Hall of Fame. Some of the other athletes that he picked up in 47, he added Horace Gillum, who was a great punter, had a lifetime average of 43.1 yards. He had been at Maslin and OSU with Paul Brown, so he remembered Horace Gillum from those years. Lynn Houston, who I mentioned earlier, had been at Maslin also, so he remembered him. In 48, he brought in Tommy James, who had been at Maslin and also at OSU, and he was a defensive back. He brought in also Dub Jones that year, who was a halfback. And people may remember Dub Jones by association. He's Burt Jones' father, who was a great quarterback with the Colts during the 70s.
Oh, okay.
And, actually, Dub Jones has another claim to fame. He scored 6 touchdowns in one game, which is the NFL record that he shares with Ernie Nevers, Gale Sayers, and just recently Alvin Kamara. Era Parsegian played for him in 1948. And we all know Era went on to be a great coach at Notre Dame. Lou Saban played for Paul Brown at Cleveland. And he went on to obviously be the Buffalo Bills coach during the O.J. Simpson years and also during their AFL championship years. One of the more interesting players, he's not as famous as some of the ones I've mentioned, but I just love his nickname, Lenny Meatball Simonetti. Meatball Simonetti actually played in New Philly High School. He was familiar with John Brickles, who I mentioned earlier, and he was a tackle for the Browns back then. I just love that. I mean, I think they made greater nicknames back then.
Oh, yeah. I think guys sitting around the bars or having a few beers had some great nicknames that we don't get to appreciate today as much. That's for sure.
No, I don't think so. I've got some good nicknames, too, but I just think the nicknames were just, you know, fantastic back then.
Yeah, they definitely were. Yeah, you know, I just want to, I'm still pondering this, you know, when you said, you know, how Brown picked and he knew he wanted Otto Graham, just take a look at that and think about that for a second. There wasn't a lot of videotape on teams. So really his only experience of seeing Otto Graham is when Northwestern played OSU. So he only had, you know, what, 50, 60 plays where he got to see him play as a tailback, you said?
Yeah. So, it was
that's an eye for talent. That's pretty good.
Yeah, it was a completely different world back then. I know one of the things that we went into in the Rams book is that the Rams had one of the first really sophisticated, you know, scouting systems because of Eddie Cattell, who was their sort of chief scout. And he did things that other teams weren't doing. And I think Paul Brown was in a way doing some of the same things, you know, by, you know, as you said, you know, realizing who these players were that he had seen and he had played against or had played for him. And, you know, he kept this in his mind and, you know, and said, well, this guy's going to be good in this position. This guy's going to be good in that position. So, you know, he was sort of doing the same thing, you know, and I think that's why it's interesting to me. I think that's why, obviously, the Browns, you know, as we know, went to 10 championship games in 10 years and won 7 of them, you know, from 46 to 55, AAFC and then in the NFL. The Rams were in championship games, you know, in 49 and 50 and 51. And then again, later in the decade in the 50s and 55. Now, 2 of those times they lost to the Browns, but 1 of those times they beat the Browns. And they were both very talented teams because of the fact that they were able to get the best talent because I think of the systems that they were using. Another thing that is common to both teams is they were the two teams that basically reintegrated pro football. The Rams initially in 46, they signed, you know, Kenny Washington and then Woody Strode. And soon thereafter, Paul Brown in the AAFC brought in Bill Willis and then Marion Motley. And Bill Willis and Marion Motley both ended up obviously being Hall of Famers. And Brown knew Bill Willis from Ohio State. He knew Marion Motley because Marion Motley had played at Great Lakes, but Marion Motley also played at Canton McKinley against Paul Brown when they were in high school and when Paul Brown was a high school coach. And Marion Motley, I think this is one of the most impressive high school statistics I know of. Marion Motley averaged 17.2 yards per carry when he was in high school. Not 7.2 or not 4 or 5 yards a carry, 17.2 yards per carry. And Paul Brown never forgot that. And, you know, so, you know, we can argue, I think, about, you know, why the NFL and then the AAFC were, you know, reintegrated, why the NFL was reintegrated. You know, obviously the African-American press in Los Angeles put pressure on Reeves since he wanted to use the Coliseum, which was publicly owned, that he had to have, you know, African-American athletes. I think Paul Brown then also realized that they were some of the best athletes. And for Paul Brown, he wanted the best athletes, regardless of the color of their skin. And he had two great ones that he brought in with Bill Willis and Marion Motley. And these players that I've mentioned proved to be, you know, the nucleus that he was able to use. You know, I think it's been well sort of told over the years that, you know, Paul Brown was a great innovator in that, you know, he was one of the first to use, you know, intelligence tests and also to test players. One of the first to have a playbook, psychological testing, you know, just a number of things that he brought to the game. I've seen a book that says that he was the father of modern football. I don't know if that's maybe a bit of a stretch, but, you know, obviously, you know, he, as I said, he brought this sort of, I guess, cerebral quality, you know, to the game. And I think that was the reason that the Browns, as you said, when we started here, it's the reason that the Browns were the upper echelon of the league and won all four championships in 4 years and basically dominated, you know, the All-America Football Conference. There were some other teams in the conference that were good, but the Browns were basically in a class by themselves. They had their first training camp at Bowling Green State University in Ohio. Their first preseason game, and it was their only preseason game that year, was on August 30th at the Rubber Bowl in Akron. And that it was interesting as I was doing my research, they played at least one exhibition game every season at the Rubber Bowl. That was a thing that they did back then. And the Rubber Bowl was actually about a little over 35,000 seat stadium. I think almost 40,000 seats. It no longer exists now. Sadly, it's it was the football stadium for the University of Akron for a number of years, but they built a new stadium on campus. And when that, the Rubber Bowl was sort of left to go. And when you go by it now, it's sort of a sad sort of relic of that time, sort of dilapidated and everything. But as a local person, there's a lot of great football games and other things that happened at the Rubber Bowl. So I was always sad to see that go, but they met the Brooklyn Dodgers there, the Brooklyn Dodgers football Dodgers. And I know you said you've already done a show, I believe on those, or you have a show coming up.
It's going to be coming in a couple of weeks here after this one. So,
They were down 13-0 in that game before approximately 36,000 and came back for a 35-20 victory in their preseason game. They then played their first regular season game on September 6th of 46 at Cleveland Stadium, had over 60,000 and beat the woeful Miami Seahawks 44-0. The Seahawks were probably the bottom dweller of the AAFC, only lasted, I think, the one season, went 3-11, and just were not a very good operation. One of the other things that, and this is sort of aside from football, but one of the other things that Paul Brown brought is that, you know, he felt that football should have some entertainment involved too. And when he was at Maslin, his band director was pretty well renowned in Ohio, and basically a person that others have sort of emulated over the years was George Red Bird. And he started the, or was instrumental in making the Tiger Swing Band, which is a Maslin Tiger marching band to this day, one of the great show bands in the country. I mean, they've actually performed all over the country. He came from Maslin, and he became Paul Brown's director of entertainment for the Browns. You know, he had a payroll to use because, you know, Paul Brown believed that you should have the whole experience. And he did that even at Maslin. So, you know, he brought these things up through the years that you know, he did. It's sort of interesting because, believe it or not, the Maslin Tiger Swing Band, they have an opening routine they do at halftime at every game. And they will announce it at the game that since 1938, they've done this same opening routine. And it was something that was back to the Red Bird days. And it's the same routine. They do it at every game. Sometimes they'll do it twice because the fans love it so much that they'll say, we've had requests to do it a second time, and they'll do it a second time. So it's just amazing. And that all started with Red Bird. Wow. So at any rate, as I said, from 46 to 49, the 4 years of the AFC, the Browns dominated. They won 51 games, lost 4 games, and tied 3. They won all 4 championships. At one time, they had a 29-game unbeaten streak. Think about that. And their masterpiece season was 1948, undefeated with the championship, 15-0. They also led all of pro football in home attendance from 47 to 49, and in 46, they were second. So they not only won, they drew well. But when you win, you draw well. Their first AAFC championship title game with the New York football Yankees in 46 at Cleveland, they won 14-9. Now, the Yankees were coached by a Hall of Fame coach themselves, Ray Flaherty. And he didn't respect the Browns. He called them a bunch of podunks coached by a high school coach. But Paul Brown got the last laugh. I think a common thread of the Browns, and we'll get into this as we finish up here, a common thread is that the Browns were dominating this league, but the Browns and Paul Brown were not necessarily respected. And I'll get into that a little bit more as we continue. As I said earlier, you know, Paul Brown did everything first class. 1947, they met Flaherty and the Yankees again, this time at Yankee Stadium. Won 14-3 that time. These are both low scoring games because one thing that the Yankees did have was the Yankees had a great defense. But the one person that they couldn't stop in either game was Marion Motley. He gained big yards in both games. And that was a common thread in these championship victories is Motley always seemed to come up big in the championship games. In 48, they destroyed Buffalo 49-7. Motley ran for 133 yards and 3 touchdowns that day. And they just destroyed that team on their way to their 15-0 season. And I think one of the interesting things that happened during that 48 season was that in 1 week, from November 21st to November 28th, Thanksgiving week, the Browns played 3 games that week and won all 3 games. If you can imagine playing 3 games, you know, in 1 week. A lot of times now when teams play on Sunday and then they play on Thanksgiving, they don't play until the following Sunday. Right. They played Sunday, Thanksgiving, and then Sunday. And wow. they beat the Yankees in New York on the 21st, 34-21. They beat the Dons in Los Angeles on Thanksgiving Day, 31-14 on the 25th. And then on the 28th, still out on the West Coast, they beat the Niners in San Francisco, 31-28. Jeez. So can you imagine playing 3 games back to back to back that way? And winning them all.
Now, George, if I can ask a question, you're talking about Marion Motley. Now, what kind of a back was he? Was he like a big bruiser, or was he like a speed demon? Does he have a combination of both? What made him so good?
He was a combination of both. I mean, if you see Marion Motley in pictures, he's a big guy to begin with, but he was a big guy who also had speed. So I think it was just that combination. It was sort of a devastating combination in that he not only was big and a banger, but he also, you know, he also was quick on his feet. So he was a complete back. I think it's always interesting to me that Paul Zimmerman, the great football writer, in his Thinking Man's Guide to Pro Football, he has a chapter of who he considers the greatest pro football player of all time, and it's Marion Motley. So, you know, and I mean, the thing about Marion Motley, too, is statistically, he really had his greatest statistics when he was in the AAFC. He still had some great years in the NFL, but I mean, he probably had his greatest years in the AAFC, but I mean, he was just, you know, a great back. And I think the thing that's interesting to me was how he always came up big in big games. There's a famous NFL films clip of him, you know, breaking like numerous tackles on the way to a long touchdown run where eventually his helmet comes off and everything. And I've probably seen that film 100 times, and it's amazing to me every time I see it. And if you ever click it, it's probably somewhere on the online somewhere. It's worth seeing that Motley touchdown run where he just breaks so many tackles, either running over people or breaking tackles. He was just, he was just amazing.
I can hear mouses clicking all over the place here around the country here as you're saying
you pair that up with the fact that, you know, the Browns had other good backs at the time. Plus they had this great passing attack with, you know, Otto Graham, who was a super accurate passer. You know, he was throwing the ball to either Dante Lavelli, Glue Fingers was his nickname. We talk about the great, you know, nicknames. And then he also had Max Beatty. He had Dub Jones, who we mentioned earlier. He just had, you know, great players. And the other thing that Paul Brown had, too, was great role players. You know, I mean, not only did he have the names that ended up in the Hall of Fame, because, you know, you got Otto Graham in the Hall of Fame. You got Lou Groza in the Hall of Fame. You got, Lavelli and Speedy now in the Hall of Fame. You have Willis in the Hall of Fame. I mean, you know, all these Hall of Famers that were the nucleus of his team. But he also had great role players that complemented the Hall of Famers, you know, from top to bottom. He just had a great team and a great sense, as you said, a great eye for talent and putting the talent, not only having the talent, but it putting the talent together. I guess it's a bold statement, but the AAFC, the Cleveland Browns are the AAFC. I mean, that's coming from somebody who lives in the Cleveland area, but I mean, you know, 4 championships, 4 years, in 49, the year we didn't cover, they beat the Niners, you know, 21-7, in Cleveland. You know, the Niners could claim that, you know, they were probably arguably the second best team, you know, in the AAFC, and they still couldn't get over the hurdle beating the Browns, you know, at least when it counted. So it was just a great run that they had. But even with that great run, and then, you know, when the league was, you know, came to a close in 49, and the Browns were luckily one of the teams that made it into the NFL, the NFL didn't respect the Browns. You know, they just thought that they were coming from a second-rate league. They didn't respect Paul Brown. They didn't respect the players. And I think that was just fodder for Paul Brown and the players to go out and then, you know, dominate the NFL that first season. That I think was their sort of, incentive to go out and do what they did. The league, obviously, set up the first game, regular season game, was against the Eagles in 1950, because the Eagles were the 2-time defending NFL champion versus the 4-time defending AAFC champion. And the Eagles at that time were coached by Earl Greasy Neal, another great nickname. And, Neal did not respect the Browns. He likened them to a basketball team because all they did, he said, was throw the ball and keep the ball up in the air. So he had no respect for the Browns. And the Browns went out, and in that first game, they dismantled the Eagles 35-10, showing the, you know, superiority. And after that, there was no questioning the Browns after that. You know, they proved that they belonged. They proved that they were a superior team by beating the defending, you know, champion of the last 2 years. And then they went on to win the NFL championship that year in one of the, great NFL championship games of all time, beating the Rams 30-28 on a lose grows a field goal in the last minute of the game. And I think one thing that's even impressive is, and you know, it's one of those things that it maybe become a bit of an urban legend, but the Browns played the Eagles a second time that year later in the year and beat them 13-7. And it was a rainy, bad weather day, December 3rd in Cleveland. And the Browns won that day without throwing a single pass. Now, Paul Brown at the time, you know, I think was trying to prove a point. What some people argue is, was he trying to prove the point that he could win after Greasy Neal said what he did? Or was it simply that they didn't need to pass the ball because the weather was so bad? But nonetheless, he proved his point. So,
you're making a comment that you said your comparison, which I think is a great comparison to Belichick. And it's making me flash back the last season with the Patriots against the Bills in that game where they didn't throw a pass and they ran the ball the whole time. So,
So I think there's, you know, there's a good example of that, because I think that there's a lot of, you know, similarities between the two. You know, and I think they had some of the great players of their era, you know, that went in, you know, as I said, you know, the first one of the, when I used to visit the Hall of Fame, you know, when I was a kid, and they used to have the charts up to show like the top 20, you know, quarterbacks of all time, the top 20 rushers of all time, the top 20 scorers and all this, and receivers. And the name that was always at the top when I was a kid was Otto Graham, you know, cause he was the, you know, he statistically, efficiency wise and everything else, the way they graded, was always the number one quarterback for years. And, you know, and you would look at it and you would say, well, those numbers don't look that impressive, but it just, the numbers were different. I that's a huge pet peeve of mine is that, you know, people want to compare, you know, players of the 50s and 60s and compare them to today's numbers. And it just, it's not a fair comparison because the numbers are different because the game's different. And it just, I think sometimes the modern or younger fan doesn't realize that, you know, it was a different game back then in terms of statistically, because of the way the defenses were and, you know, much, you know, everything else that, you know, I mean, the Browns had a very sophisticated passing attack, obviously, for their time. And that was another reason for their success, was that they were able to mix all that together. But, you know, they were just an amazing team for that 10-year period. And I feel that you can make a solid argument that, you know, Otto Graham, I know we've heard the arguments about Tom Brady. I think you can make a solid argument that, you know, Otto Graham should be considered in any discussion of who the quarterback GOAT is.
So, that's a good point.
You know, and I think you can do the same with Marion Motley at the running back position. Even though the Browns have always had a great, obviously, pedigree of running backs with Jim Brown and Leroy Kelly and most recently Nick Chubb, and, you know, others in between, the Pruitts and everything else. The Browns have always been blessed with great running backs, but, you know, Marion Motley was, you know, arguably, you know, the first great running back that they had. And he, you know, paved the way for the rest. And then you have, you know, just, you know, some of the other great players at the positions that they played at receiver and everything else. I mean, it was just, it was a great football team.
Yeah. And you were saying, you know, talking earlier, saying, you know, the Browns were the AAFC and you were, you know, kind of sheepish saying, you know, because you're from that area. Well, you know, we were fortunate enough going through this series, going through, you know, team by team, you know, Larry Schmidt in New York City, he's telling us, hey, the Brown, you know, a lot of salutations to the Browns. Or Joe Heschen from the 49ers aspect is telling us, you know, about great things. And almost all of them, you know, Ken Crippen, another one that, you know, talked on and on. And all of them are, anytime that their teams, their AAFC teams they were talking about would either, you know, give the Browns their one of their four defeats or take the Browns to the wire or only lose by three or something. That was a high point of those AAFC franchises. Yeah. That were not the Browns. That's how important the Browns were to the AFC. So
it's interesting to hear that. That's fascinating to me. But yeah, I think it's true. And I think it was true. You know, I think a lot of people put Paul Brown down because he came, you know, from a high school. But you know, he I think always felt that, you know, football is football, no matter what level it is. And if you have the right system and you apply it the right way, there's going to be success at every level. And I think he truly believed that, you know, and I think that, you know, he laid the groundwork when he was, you know, at Maslin, you know, and I think that's all well depicted. You know, the Maslin Museum has a Paul Brown Museum now, which we visited last year during our convention. And, you know, and I think they play off the fact that, you know, just, you know, the foundation that he laid in that regard was, you know, and a lot of people didn't respect him because they said, well, you know, he's at high school and all this. As I said, that Ray Flaherty said, oh, he's just a high school coach. Well, no, he was much more than just a high school coach. You know, you see the excellence at every level, and he had excellence at every level. And I don't think many coaches can really say that. You know, I mean, he just had excellence at every single level that he played, that he coached at.
You know, going back to our discussion we had with Canton and Maslin talking about Paul Brown, and, you know, I didn't realize that, and I think we even mentioned it during that podcast, is, you know, Paul Brown may be the only coach that won a national championship at the high school, the collegiate, and the professional level.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe somebody like Pete Carroll, if he won at high school, I don't know if he did right. or not. Maybe he's the only one who can even come close to that. But that's an amazing fact, you know.
Yeah, I've never researched it, but he could very well be the only one. You may be right. It'd be interesting to research that to see if there's anybody else that had that trifecta. But yeah, because you're right, he did. He not only won state championships in football, he also won what was considered at the time national championships. You know, and he did that there, and then he, you know, won the national championship at Ohio State, and then obviously went right into the AFC and won championships, and eventually won the NFL championship, you know. So obviously pre-Super Bowl era, but, you know, I always like to tell people the Super Bowl is the NFL championship game. You know, it's just called the Super Bowl. So, you know.
True. Very so true.
People always, you know, I again, you know, Super Bowl era, there was a lot of great football in the NFL before the Super Bowl era. So Browns proved that, and other teams, the great, you know, Packers teams of the 30s, and you know, the great, you know, Green Bay teams. Obviously the Green Bay was the one team that sort of straddled both eras, winning, you know, the early championships for Lombardi and then winning once they got into the Super Bowl. But, you know, I think that's the other thing, is that the Browns can be included in that argument of the best team ever, and are obviously one of the, you know, dynasty teams of the league. You know, the Browns had their dynasty in the 50s, and then you had the Packers in the 60s. You know, obviously the Niners, and we had the Steelers in the 70s. Then you had the Cowboys and the Niners, and, you know, so, and then obviously the Patriots in recent years. But, you know, I think they're one of those teams that can be included in that dynasty argument.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I think maybe only the Packers in the Browns that you're talking about, you know, they have, you know, seven, both of them had like seven appearances in the championship games in a 10 year period. That's unbelievable. Yeah. That's not even, you know, the great, you know, the Steelers and the 49ers and the Cowboys and even the Patriots. They didn't do that. Well, maybe the Patriots got close, but they didn't win as many as
right.
in a row, but that's just an amazing feat. And especially for what was an upstart team, you know, when you're doing it right from the word go and yeah. you're winning, that's truly amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, it really is. And, you know, just it's really an amazing record that the Browns put together during that time frame. So it's a great legacy for the Cleveland area and just football in general.
Yeah, it certainly is. And I'm glad that Cleveland was able to keep the Browns name and the traditions and everything when the whole thing happened at the end of the 90s and got to have a team back. Yeah, so that's a great
yeah,
piece of tradition to have.
Yeah, I'm really glad when they moved the team to Baltimore that they didn't take the name with them, because, you know, I always remember that when the Colts left, you know, Baltimore and they went to Indianapolis and they still kept the nickname the Colts. I know a lot of the former Colts players that didn't sit right with them. I remember Johnny Unitas saying, hey, I didn't play in Indianapolis, you know, so, you know, I think it's always interesting that, you know, what that means to these players. And, you know, that just didn't sit right with some of those Colts players. So I'm glad that they did keep the nickname, the colors and everything else.
Yeah, and no, I don't know if I've ever asked you this, but I know I've asked some other people about this. Just taking the sort of that parallels we're talking about, you know, you had the Cleveland Rams, you know, winning the championship like you discussed earlier, and then leaving, actually almost soon right after that, going to LA. Right. So you have a city that's like, hey, we're the champs, and our team's leaving, thank goodness, like you said earlier, that the Browns came in and filled that big void that was in their hearts. But, is that worse than the Browns being sort of taken from the city? And, they didn't have a championship that year, but they were, very big fan base, no matter what their record was. And they were a team on the rise at the time. What do you think maybe is worse for the city?
I think worse than when the Browns left.
The Browns left?
Much worse. That was just a really painful time for Northeast Ohio because the Browns, I think, are still when they're – I still feel that it's mostly a football – even though we have the Guardians now and obviously the Cavs and the LeBron James years, I've always felt that the one championship that would mean the most to this area would be a Brown Super Bowl championship. So I think that it's just one of those things that, whereas I think when the Rams left, because you had the Browns filling the void almost immediately, I don't think that was, as bad. Plus, as I said, whereas the area didn't seem to really necessarily embrace the Rams, they almost immediately embraced the Browns. And maybe it was because of Paul Brown and the Ohio background and everything else, because, it was just a little bit, different. I mean, obviously the Rams were during the war years and everything else, and, in fairness too, into the situation, I mean, as I said, Reeves always had a plan in mind that he wanted to take the team to Los Angeles. He saw that as a promised land. And actually, that was his pioneer moment because he opened that up to, major sports. If it wasn't for him, you wouldn't have had the Dodgers and then the Giants moving out that way and the Lakers and everything else. He was the first to go out there and realize that, this could be a mecca for pro sports. But, the Rams were at one time playing at a high school stadium. They played at Old Shaw High School Stadium, which is in an area that I work in on Thursdays. And I mean, it's a nice high school stadium. It's in a very, old, neighborhood. But I mean, it was a high school stadium. It's always interesting to me when I drive by and realize that pro football games were played at this high school stadium, NFL games. And that's always just, it's hard to get my arms around this. That's why it's hard sometimes for me to get my arms around the fact that how Paul Brown was not respected, because now we know who Paul Brown was. And he not only, was instrumental with the Browns, but also the Bengals. How many coaches can say, and coaches can say that they were responsible for two franchises? Because even though Mickey McBride owned the Browns, I mean, Paul Brown was the architect, and then he became the architect of the Bengals. How many can say that two teams that they were architects for? That's just true. An amazing thing. And now what we know about Paul Brown, for them to say, oh, he's just a high school coach and all this and all that, my goodness. it's an amazing history.
Yeah, that's a great thing. I mean, that whole league is very interesting. We appreciate you sharing that with the Browns. Now, before I let you go, I want to make sure, see what's going on. What's the vibe going on with the PFRA these days?
Yeah, we have the third book in our Great Team series is going to be coming out here very soon, probably in May. Just finished editing the proofs for that book, and I'm pretty sure if it didn't go to the publisher here in the last 24 hours, it's pretty close to the printer. It's pretty close to going to the printer. So that book will be published here very shortly. We're already in the works on our fourth book, which is going to be on the 64 Bills. And we've already decided our fifth book is going to be on the 76 Raiders. So that's going very strong. Otherwise, we've been planning our 2023 convention, and I can't reveal the site yet, but we're going to probably be revealing that shortly. So that's coming up next year, the 2023 convention. We're real excited about the choice that we made, and I think the membership will be real excited about that too. So those are some of the big things that we've been working on that are coming up. So on a smaller level, our Buffalo Western New York chapter holds a chapter meeting every year that's actually pretty well attended every year from the area and beyond. And that's coming up this coming Saturday. We're excited about that. Jeff Miller and the people at the Buffalo area do a really good job on that little sort of mini chapter meeting that they have every year. So that's also coming up as one of our chapters. So some exciting times for the PFRA, and we're looking forward to this year and beyond.
And I would like to point out too, you know, for those that are listening that are not members and want to, you know, have some great fellowship and learn about some great pro football history and talk with some others of the same interest. Yeah. It's a very reasonable $35 a year.
It is.
I believe the website's what? PFRA.org?
Profootballresearchers.org. You can get there and then join. You get our magazine, The Coffin Corner, comes out 6 times a year. And you also get access to our members only section, which is just a fantastic sort of archive of football information for the fan out there. In fact, whenever I get a new member, they're always anxious to get their members only login so they can get in there and look at some of the things we have on there. We've got some great things posted in there, and people love that section. And it's a great organization. Believe me, if you're a football lover, it's definitely worth joining the PFRA, and it's a great organization. And by being a member, also, if you come to our conventions, the fee is less for members. So I always say that, you know, if you're a member, that's also a perk, is that you get in for a reduced fee at our conventions. So that's always a perk also.
And I can tell you this for a fact, the information is evergreen. It's always good. Yep. As a matter of fact, our friend Joe Zagorski, I was digging through some old Coffin Corner articles, and I was doing some research on the coal mining leagues, and I found one from 1979 by Joe Zagorski on the Anthracite League. And Joe is going to be, actually, I'm going to be talking to him later this week, probably airing next week after this episode is on, talking about the Anthracite League and the article that Joe wrote so many years ago. Yeah. So it's a great, great thing. So, but George, I really appreciate you spending time with us, sharing your knowledge and your love of the Browns, and really a fascinating team and a really good team. And we appreciate you coming on here and sharing that with us tonight.
Thanks. I really enjoyed it. Take care, Darren.
You too, George. Peeking up at the clock, the time's running down. We're going to go into victory formation, take a knee, and let this baby run out. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you back tomorrow for the next podcast.
We invite you to check out our website, pigskindispatch.com, not only to see the daily football history, but to experience positive football with our many articles on the good people of the game, as well as our own football comic strip, Cleat Marks Comics. Pigskindispatch.com is also on social media outlets, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and don't forget the Pigskin Dispatch YouTube channel to get all of your positive football news and history. A special thanks to the talents of Mike and Gene Monroe, as well as Jason Neff, for letting us use their music during our podcast.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
Hey there, football fans. This is Ross, the host of the Pigskin Tales podcast. I just need a few moments of your time to talk about the host of the Pigskin Dispatch podcast, Darren Hayes. He's expanded the Pigpen to search out information on the history of all team sports. It's a quest to find out about the competitors, teams, and places chronicled throughout athletic history through the uniforms and gear the participants used and wore. And he is taking you, the listener, with him on this educational journey to preserve sports history on the Sports Jersey Dispatch, found here on the Sports History Network. His newest podcast, called Jersey Dispatch, is all based on the jerseys that all the greats used to wear. You can find Darren Hayes and the Pigskin Dispatch podcast, as well as Jersey Dispatch, on your favorite podcast provider multiple times each week. So remember that Darren Hayes, the host of the Pigskin Dispatch and Jersey Dispatch podcasts, it's found right here on the Sports History Network.